I've got a question for you as we begin. The question is, do you feel that Christianity is in a strong position in the UK at the moment? Do you feel that Christianity is in a strong position at the moment? Do you feel that as you look across the country that the church is thriving in any way? Or perhaps as you look more locally across Wiltshire, across Swindon, I don't know the answer to this, but do you think that the church is strong in this area, in this part of the country? You see, in our country, in Britain, there are just under 200,000 conservative evangelical Christians worshipping on a Sunday. Just under 200,000. That's conservative evangelicals. By that I mean people who hold to the centrality of the cross as the way of getting right with God and the authority of Scripture. And that's across all sort of denominational lines, FIEC, Anglican churches, Grace Baptists, the Presbyterians, Baptist Union churches that are evangelical, New Frontiers, anything that's sort of broadly conservative evangelical. There are less than 200,000 across Britain. To put that into perspective, that would be like all the conservative evangelical Christians coming and living in Swindon, and then there being none in the rest of Britain. It puts it into perspective, doesn't it? It's not that many in our country. And I don't know about you, when I stop and think like that, if you ever do stop and think like that, it can make you feel a little bit down. It makes you feel a little bit like we're up against it, like we're a bit weak. Especially then when you consider the great wave of anti-Christian sentiment in the media and in culture. And perhaps you face some of that yourself. Maybe in the workplace, as you go public with your Christian faith, there are perhaps little comments made. Or in your family, perhaps people say things when they hear your opinion on something. It's not easy being a Christian in the 21st century. But of course that's nothing new. In many parts of the world it's far more difficult to be a Christian. And throughout the history of the church, many Christians have found it very difficult to believe in Jesus. It's been very hard. And that was certainly the case in the first century. This letter from Jesus to the church in Philadelphia is one of the seven letters at the beginning of Revelation. And the church in Philadelphia was a faithful church. In your Bible, if you've got Revelation 3 open, you may have a heading that the Bible translators have put in that says the faithful church. They were a faithful church. They were a church that was continuing to believe in Jesus. They were faithful, but there weren't that many of them. When you compared it to the great culture around them, they were in a large, diverse place on a major trade junction, the M4 corridor of their day. They were thriving and growing, but comparatively speaking, the church was weak. You see that in verse 8. Jesus says, you have a little strength. You've kept my word. You've not denied my name. So they're a gospel-centered church. They're keeping on going with Jesus. But, he says, they have a little strength. Not much strength, a little strength. They have some, but not lots. Some translations have, you have just a little power. Just a little power, a little strength. But Jesus commands them, even though they're up against it in the culture, they're up against it in their daily living, he commands them something in verse 11. He says, hold fast what you have. Hold fast what you have. It's a command. It's a command in the present tense, in the original, which means keep holding on. Hold on, hold fast, and keep holding on. Keep believing, keep holding on. So Jesus gives them that command. That's the application. That's the application for us. I'm going to front load it. That's what we need to do. The whole passage is reasons why we can keep holding on to Jesus. This passage is going to give us three reasons why we can keep holding fast to the gospel message. Three reasons why we can keep believing in Jesus. So if we're feeling weak, if we're feeling up against it in the culture, up against it amongst our work colleagues, our families, in the area that we live, we can hold on to Jesus for three reasons. The first is this. We believe in his power. We believe in his power. Hold on to Jesus because we believe in his power. Now, in each of these letters in Revelation, I appreciate we're just doing one of them that comes in the middle of the section. Jesus always describes himself in a slightly different way at the beginning of the letter and often has a sort of different angle on who he is. And we can see that in verse 7. The angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, He who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. Jesus holds the key of David, he says, and he's opened something. He's opened a door. What's going on? Well, firstly, the key of David is a reference to two passages in the Bible, Isaiah 22 and Matthew 16. In Isaiah 22, Isaiah promises that one day someone's going to come who is going to be a great figure who is going to have the keys of the kingdom, having authority and holding the kingdom secure, keeping the kingdom firm. Now, Isaiah primarily was talking about someone in that time who was going to come, but he was pointing forward to Jesus, who would have the keys of David. So it's a reference to Isaiah 22. It's also a reference to Matthew 16, where Jesus says that all authority has been given me by the Father, and he has the keys of the kingdom. And if you know that passage, Jesus then says in Matthew 16 that he gives the keys to the kingdom to the church. He allows the church to make certain decisions about who is a church member, what churches believe, how to appoint elders. Jesus gives authority to the church, but in Revelation 3, the emphasis here is all on Jesus having authority and power because he has the key. He has the key to the place, the key to the kingdom, and because he has the key, he has power and authority. There's a little ceremony at the Tower of London called the Ceremony of the Keys. Have you heard about this? It happens every night, and it's happened for centuries. It's one of these strange British traditions. You can even get tickets to watch it. At 9:52 exactly every night, the Chief Yeoman Warder of the Tower, that's a great title, isn't it? Chief Yeoman Warder of the Tower comes out with a lantern in one hand and keys in another. You heard about this? And he walks to the Traitor's Gate, where he's met by some foot guards, and he's escorted to an outer gate to lock up at the end of the day. He's locking up the Tower of London. But as he returns to the Traitor's Gate, he's greeted by the sentry who says, "Halt! Who comes there?" And the Chief Yeoman Warder of the Tower says, "The keys." And the sentry says, "Whose keys?" And the Chief Yeoman Warder of the Tower replies, "Queen Elizabeth's keys." And then the sentry says, "Pass, all's well then." This happens every night. You can get tickets for it if you so desire. Now, my favourite bit of that slightly random British ceremony is the bit where they say, "Whose keys?" As if it was, you know, someone's car keys. Whose keys is it? It's the Queen's keys, Queen Elizabeth's keys. Why is that significant? Because it's the keys to the tower. It's not just the locking up procedure. It symbolizes something. It symbolizes power and authority, the right to be there, the crown, the jewels, the monarchy, the kingdom. Symbolized in the keys, Queen Elizabeth's keys. And that's the sense here in Revelation 3. Jesus has the keys. He has the power. He has the authority because he's got those keys. But the question is, whose keys? Because actually, Revelation 3 says they're not Jesus' keys. Do you see that? What does it say? Verse 7. He has the key of David. It's David's keys. That's because Jesus is a king in the line of David. He's in David's family. Way back in 2 Samuel 7, God made a covenant with David, a covenant where he promised that one day a king would rule from David's line and would rule forever. And that Davidic covenant, the covenant with David, is a huge covenant in the Old Testament. In many ways, the whole Old Testament story revolves around that. And the kingly idea of kingly rule is central. For example, Adam and Eve, they in some sense ruled like kings. They had authority and responsibility to subdue the world for God's glory. Other Old Testament people who we might not normally think of as kings sort of act like kings. Pontedrin, this term, we're going through Genesis in the morning, and we've been looking at the life of Abraham. And one of the interesting things, I think, about the life of Abraham is, in many ways, he is like a king. In many ways, he battles other kings. He interacts with other kings on a sort of one-to-one level. He is like a king, ruling. It's a sort of prefiguring of the kings, in many ways. Of course, Israel had many kings in their history, but they were all pointing forward to one king who would rule forever, Jesus. Jesus is the great king from God in David's family ruling. And that's why it's the keys of David. He's in David's line with power and authority. And that's why it says in verse 7, he's got the key and he opens, no one can shut. And when he shuts something, no one can open it again. And that's the sense in verse 8 as well. He says, "I know your works, See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. Jesus here is explicitly referring to a door. He says, the door is open, no one can shut it. So what's he talking about this open door? Some people suggest it could be a reference to an open door for mission, because that's often the way that that word is used in the Bible, in the book of Acts, and in Paul's letters. The door is open for mission. He could be saying to the church in Philadelphia, the door is open to share the good news with people around you. Jesus has opened that door. There is an opportunity now. The harvest is ripe, he says, in other places. That's certainly possible. It could well be. The particular context here is he's talking about the kingdom. He's talking about the keys to the kingdom. So I think there's at least some sense in which Jesus is saying the door is open. Jesus has opened the door to receive people into the kingdom. He has died on the cross to pay the price of redemption. He has been raised again for our justification. Jesus is the one who decides who's in and out of the kingdom. Jesus is the one who shuts people out if they refuse to acknowledge him, and he's the one who receives people in if they accept him. Depending on how we respond to Jesus is how we respond to God's kingdom. To mix the metaphor slightly, John, the writer of Revelation, in his gospel says Jesus is the door. Jesus says that, doesn't he? John records that. He is the door. He is the entrance into God's kingdom. If we want to get to God's kingdom, it's through Jesus and his death on the cross. That's what he says. And that's, I think, the sense here. Jesus has the keys. He's got the power, the authority to receive people into the kingdom. We can hold on to Jesus because we believe that he has power. He has the power as God's king in David's line. But there's just one more thing I want to point out in verse 7. How is Jesus described? He who is holy, he who is true. Now, I want you to keep a finger in that passage. Flick forward to Revelation 6, just probably across the page. Revelation 6:10, where this is the cry of the martyrs in Revelation 6. In 6:10, they say, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth. How is God described? Holy and true. How is Jesus described? Holy and true. You see, Jesus is a king from David's line. He's fully human. A human king, fully human in David's line. But he's also fully God. He is holy and true. Words which are used only really to describe God. He is fully God and fully man. And because of that, his power cannot be matched. We can hold on to Jesus because we believe in his power. So if you're feeling weak, feeling perhaps vulnerable in our society as Christians, feeling that perhaps Christians are somehow under the cosh, the great encouragement this morning, the first reason we can hold on to Jesus is we believe in his power. He has authority. We are in his kingdom. We're on his team, if you like. We are confident that he has the power and we know him. We can hold on to Jesus because we believe in his power. That's the first reason. The second is we benefit from his protection. Now, the church was facing opposition from the outside in Philadelphia. Unlike some of the churches in the letters of Revelation, there weren't that many problems on the inside. Some of the churches have a number of problems that they have to deal with on the inside. This church in Philadelphia was actually pretty faithful to the gospel. They were having Bible teaching. They were having witnessing. They were doing many good things. The pressure for them was from the outside, not from the inside. You can see that in verse 9. Jesus says, I'll make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I'll make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. It seems that there were some back then who were claiming to be Jews, claiming to be having therefore allegiance to God, allegiance to the covenant that God had made with David, amongst others, but they were actually opposing God's plans. They were opposing God's people. Now this is specifically a first century issue of the non-Jews, Gentiles, being included into God's plans, and perhaps some Jews opposing that. I know you've been going through the book of Hebrews, and some of the background there is that God's people were perhaps being tempted, pressurized to come away from their hope in Jesus back to the old way of things, the old religion. Perhaps some of that is the background here in Philadelphia too. this opposition from the outside, persecution from the outside. But there is a broader point. The point that Jesus is making here as well is that religious affiliation, religious tradition, religious background and upbringing doesn't automatically get you into God's kingdom. It doesn't automatically mean you are on God's side. That's, of course, true today, isn't it? Just because you've grown up in a good Bible-teaching church doesn't automatically mean you are in God's kingdom. It doesn't mean you're automatically on God's side. These people in verse 9 were opposing God's people. And therefore, Jesus says, they're actually not synagogue of God. They're a synagogue of Satan, because Satan always opposes God's plans. And they are opposing God's plans here. And they actually belong to the devil, he says. So the church is facing pressure from the outside, but Jesus promises them protection. You see that verse 9? He says, I'll make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. People will know that Jesus loves his church. That's what he says. He's going to make sure everybody is aware of that, that Jesus loves them. He's keeping them. He looks after his own. They're his family. He wants to protect them. He loves them. There appears to be here some sort of public vindication of the church. Now, it could be at the end of time that happens. It could be something referring in those days. I'm not sure. But either way, he says, people are going to know that I love you, he says. So this church in Philadelphia, who are feeling a bit weak, they have a little strength, he says, I am going to make sure that people know that I love you. And that's what he's saying in verse 10 as well. Because you've kept my command to persevere, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that shall come upon the whole earth to test those who dwell on the earth. They're keeping his word, so Jesus says he's going to keep them from trial. Now, some people have taken this to be referring to some sort of pre-tribulation rapture, if that sort of those words that I've just said make any sense. So some sort of tribulation in the world, and Jesus is going to take his people out of the world before that happens. I don't think that's what Jesus is referring to. I think what he's saying is, in this world where there will be tribulation, there'll be trials, there'll be temptations, there'll be difficult things, he is going to keep his people. He's going to protect his people. They're keeping his word. He is going to keep them. That's what he's saying. The world is broken and testing us, but Jesus is going to protect us. He's going to keep us. We have to hold on to him. Remember, that's the command. Hold on, verse 11, hold fast. We have to hold on to him, but Jesus says he's the one who's going to hold on to us. He's the one who's going to keep us. There's a play park near where we live where there's a zip wire for children, and we took our five-year-old son Seth on it, and the first time he went on it, he was quite nervous to go on it. So we sort of, you know, put him on it, and he said, Daddy, you know, look after me, don't drop me. So I said, well, what I'll do is I'll run alongside with it, and I'll hold on. You've got to hold on tight, but I'm going to make sure you don't fall. So when we went along, he was holding on for dear life, holding on. But of course, if he'd let go, would he have fallen down? No, because I was holding him. He had to hold on. He's got to hold on fast, hold on tight. But I, in the end, was the one that was looking after him. I was the one who was protecting him, who was keeping him. And in the same way, God's people are to hold on. We're to hold on to Jesus. Hold fast, it says. But we know that we're being held on by him. He's the one holding us. That's what he says, doesn't he, in verse 10. You've kept my command to persevere. I'm going to keep you. I'm going to hold on to you. It's what theologically is known as the perseverance of the saints. God's people will persevere to the end. God will keep and protect his people. In the Reformation in the 16th century, this was such an important point, such an important belief. One confession of faith put it like this. This is from some Reformed churches in France. It says this. We believe that faith is not given to the elect to introduce them into the right way, but to make them continue in it to the end. For as it is of God who has begun the work, he will also perfect it. In other words, God will keep and protect his people. That's what Jesus is saying. Isn't that a great source of comfort to us this morning? As we are commanded to hold on to Jesus, He's the one holding on to us. He's the one protecting us. So perhaps this morning, when you think about it, do you ever think, as you think about the future, do you ever wonder, you know, will I always believe? Maybe I will fall away. You know, maybe I won't make it to heaven. Well, Jesus says he will keep us. Or perhaps as you think about pressure from outside, maybe in the workplace, people who say perhaps hostile things or difficult conversations you have with family members, or as you look at the news and go on Twitter or Facebook or however you sort of look at things and you see this opposition from the outside, hostility, and you think, I don't know in the future whether I can continue to believe. Can I really hold on? But Jesus says, I will keep you. He protects his own, he says. He will keep us. We're his. He will see us through to the end. Of course, we have to keep holding on ourselves. Verse 11 says, hold fast. It's a command. We've got to keep doing it. But Jesus says, he will keep us. That's because if we've been born again, 1 Peter says, we've been born again into an imperishable seed. So imperishable seed, a seed that will not die. We have been born again into an eternal hope. The cross of Jesus does not just achieve the possibility of salvation, it actually achieves salvation. It actually gets something done. It achieves salvation so that the job is already done. We will one day be saved and taken to be with God because that work has already been done for us. His people will persevere. So when times are tough, when comments are made about you, perhaps by those who you love, when it's difficult to be a Christian, when it's difficult to hold on, the great encouragement we have this morning is that we will benefit from his protection. So keep holding on, Jesus says. So that's the second reason we've seen that we will benefit from his protection. We've seen that we believe in his power. And thirdly, finally, we will be in his presence. That's what he says in verse 11. Now, Jesus has told us the future, verse 11. I'm coming quickly. God has revealed the future. Only God knows the future, of course, but he has revealed some of that to us. He's coming back. We're going to go one day into a world with Jesus forever, living with him, dwelling with Jesus for all time. And that's the wonderful encouragement that we have in verse 12. He says, he who overcomes, continues to the end, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. He shall go out no more. I'll write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem which comes down out of heaven from my God. And I will write on him my new name. Isn't that wonderful? These promises are promises of being with God, being with him in his presence, dwelling with God forever. And it's described as being a pillar in the temple, being a pillar in the temple, a pillar that will be secure in God's place forever. Now, if you know the end of the book of Revelation, you'll know that actually John says there will be no temple in the new heavens and the new earth. There won't be a temple there because God will be everywhere. He won't be consigned to sort of symbolically dwelling in one place. He'll be everywhere. But Jesus says, you know, metaphorically, we are going to be pillars in that temple. It's not going to be a literal temple, but we're going to be there. We're going to be there. Secure, steadfast, unmoved, he says. He shall go out no more. We will be with God forever, never leaving his presence. Isn't that wonderful? Doesn't that make you want to worship and continue believing? We will be with God, be in his presence. But there's even more. He says, not just will we be in his presence, we'll have his identity, we'll have his name. Did you catch that when it was read? I will write on him the name of my God, the name of the Father he's referring to. And then he says at the end of verse 12, I will write on him my new name. I think the newness is the fact that he will then be the victorious Christ, the one who has returned and everything has been put right again. He will give us his name. There's another name as well. Now, you might expect it to be the name of the Spirit. We've had the God, the Father and the Son. You might expect it to be the Spirit. It's actually something else. The name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem. We're going to have the name of the city as well. Now, city and town names are important. Cumbran means the Valley of the Crow. Yeah? Wikipedia told me that Swindon means pig hill. This is lovely. The name of the city in Revelation 3 is Philadelphia, meaning brotherly love. It's named after a particular individual, and the city had been renamed a few different times over the years as well. It was named Neo-Caesarea and Flavia after different people who'd rebuilt it. So the place that they were living in had had different names, names associated with different things at different eras. But this church is going to get a new name, and the new name is going to be the New Jerusalem. That's because Jerusalem was the place where God symbolically dwelt with his people. They're going to be with God in his presence. They're going to have his name, his presence among them, his identity. They have a new citizenship, a citizenship of belonging to this New Jerusalem. It's what Paul means elsewhere when he says our citizenship is in heaven in Philippians. We belong to God now. That's where we're headed. And of course, the reason that Jesus is saying all this is to give them reasons to obey verse 11. Behold, I'm coming quickly. Hold fast to what you have, that no one may take your crown. Hold fast, he says, because one day we will be in his presence and be with him forever. So they can endure now, even though they face opposition, they face difficulties, pressures from the outside, they have a wonderful promise to come. Now, I don't know if you saw a few weeks ago that someone ran a marathon in under 2 hours. Did you catch that on the news? What an extraordinary achievement to run a marathon in under 2 hours. Incredible. Now, just imagine being in that last mile. Imagine you've run 25 miles. You've got just over 1 mile to go. Imagine your legs are beginning to ache. Your heart is racing. There's sweat on your forehead. Your arms are swinging. What keeps you going? What gets you over that last little bit? Well, it's getting over the finish line, isn't it? It's the joy, the achievement, the crown, the satisfaction of getting the job done. Now, I appreciate probably a marathon feels quite a stretch for us to think about, for most of us at least. Imagine doing a park run. Does anybody do park runs here? A park run is 5 kilometres, 3.1 miles, a little bit more achievable than perhaps a marathon. Though even 5 kilometres, that's quite a long way to run. Imagine you're going in right at the end. You're hot, you're out of breath. What keeps you going? Well, it's the well done at the end. It's the crown, it's the applause, it's the satisfaction of it. It's the winner's medal. And that's the sense in verse 11. Hold on to what you've got. Don't let that crown slip. Don't let the winner's medal fall off. Keep going. It's what people call being heavenly minded, having a focus on eternity. In the trials of life, have our eyes lifted, lifted ahead, lifted to heaven, to our hope there. Not just to focus on the here and now. When we're running a park run, a marathon, we don't just look at the here and now. You've got to look to the finish line. You've got to look ahead. You've got to have that motivation. And that's what Jesus is saying here. The motivation of the crown to come, being with God forever. That needs to be our motivation, Jesus says. So this week, when the trials come, this passage encourages us to call to mind the crown that we have. When we're in the midst of struggles, perhaps feeling weak, perhaps feeling with a little strength, recalling our heavenly citizenship, recalling our future dwelling with God, being a pillar in his temple. Or when opposition comes in the workplace, when another comment is made by a family member, when the cheap shot is made, remember the power of Jesus, that he has authority, he has the keys. He's got the keys of the kingdom. He's opened the door and we're in because we have received him. Allow that truth to affect our thinking. Allow that to be in our minds. Lift our eyes beyond the present to the crown to come and hold on tight to Jesus because he's holding on to us, he says.